The site is coming up.
Okay, so please.
It's a pleasure and an honor to be here at the Field Institute to tell you a little bit about what we do. And I wasn't too sure what the audience would be like, so I talk about computational fluid dynamics. I thought I'd show you a few things that we've done in our laboratory. On the lower left is one of the first, to our knowledge, the first calculation of the motion of a jellyfish, in which it uses no experimental data. It's done from Newton's second law, first principle. On the top is some videos of jellyfish that were shot by a colleague of mine last summer and on the West Coast. The top right is a fluid structure interaction. It's an array of two cylinders, one behind the other, that are mounted on the springs, and the flow is from left to right, and the flow induces vibrations. And the last one on the bottom here is the turbulent flow behind a square block close to the wall, so that we see that what happens to the vortex shedding. So I had to show a couple of animations, video clips. Now they won't shut down. All right, try another one. It worked before. Okay, here's one. Here's another one. So I'll talk to you today on flow analysis and design, some issues and challenges in CFD, and the subtitle would be accuracy, reliability, and uncertainty. I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but you have two engineers talking to you this evening, and engineers are a funny breed. And last week I met someone who told me this story about a mathematician, a physicist, and an engineer are given a red sphere and asked to compute the volume of the sphere. So the mathematician takes a ruler, measures the diameter, then computes a triple integral and gets an answer. The physicist takes a bucket of water, measures the displacement, and gets the volume. The engineer looks up the serial number on the balloon, on the red ball, and looks up in his handbook and finds the volume and the weight. Then the following week, the engineer again shows up with a surgeon and a lawyer, and they're discussing the nature of God. And the surgeon says, God made Eve from a rib taken on Adam, so God must have been a surgeon. The engineer said, no, you're wrong. God must have been an engineer to bring order out of chaos. And the lawyer said, who do you think made chaos? I'll give you a little bit of background about who I am, and I belong to this GMIAO group, which is a computational engineering group at Ecole Polytechnique. There's six of us, and dealing with various aspects of fluid mechanics and computations. A few things about what fluid mechanics is, and fluid mechanics goes back to 336 AD with Heraclitus of Ephesus, who said, he was a philosopher who said, everything flows. Then there are some fairly well-known names like Da Vinci, who wrote De moto dell'acqua, on the motion of water. Newton's famous for his second law. And Navier and Stokes here are famous for the Navier-Stokes equations, which I'll talk a little bit more about. I was told there was an optimization seminar, so I have to put an optimization slide. And to put things in context, so suppose you're looking for alpha star, the design parameters that minimize the cost function J. So J of U and alpha star will be smaller than any other evaluation. And this, you look for this minimum subject to G of U and alpha are the equals zero constraint. And in this case, G will be the Navier-Stokes equations made up with the continuity equation, which is conservation of mass for incompressible fluids, and the momentum equations, which is nothing but Newton's second law. A motion. And I was looking for a definition of CFD, and in a nutshell, it's the art of replacing the fluid flow partial differential equations, which are nearly impossible to solve, by something that's a UJX equals B that can be done on the computer. At least we hope so. And I thought I'd say a few things about where CFD stands in the scientific method. Sorry, the framing of the aspect ratio of the screen is not quite right. Analysis and design can proceed in either of three ways. So experimentation, analytical models, or computational models. And in our case, if you do experiments, you need to involve intuition and empiricism. The best example would be a wind tunnel in which you collect data for lift and drag of an airfoil or a plane. You get a collection of measurements, and the best example is the Wright brothers. They were bicycle makers, and they built airplanes, and they knew nothing about the theory of aerodynamics. But they could run a wind tunnel and figure out of the dozens of designs they had, which was the best. When you talk about doing theory, you're basically looking for closed form solutions, and these provide explanation and insight into what goes, what gives. But usually the simplifications are so important that it's a crude approximation of reality. It's quantitatively not very seldom useful. CFD is the confluence of applied mathematics, computing, and engineering science, and it blends them together so that we can do little or no simplification of the problem. But the mathematical model that we put in for the physics is critical. And for instance, I'll show you some examples later about appropriate and inappropriate turbulence models. And the solution is a set of discrete values. So we lose the fact that when you have a function, you can differentiate and find trends. And in the beginning, CFD was really painful and slow. In 1910, Richardson, of Richardson fame for the extrapolation, used human computers, spelled with an O, meaning they were slaves. And they were doing this amazing speed of 2,000 floating point operations per week. There was a big room filled with desks, and people were shoveling papers from one another. In 1953, Kawaguchi used a mechanical calculator, one of those big things with a crank, and he did the first serious Navier-Stokes flow around a cylinder, and he worked for 18 months, 20 hours a week. So you're talking about determination. And we've done some fantastic improvements. Nowadays, you can get 10 to the power 9 off floating point operation on your desktop easily. So the trigger event that may put CFD on the map, give it its impulse, was the advent of the computer with John von Neumann. So I put a few things here, and Cray was at the heart of many of the developments. So we'll use CFD for several reasons, because essentially because of its cost-benefit ratio, and it has other properties that are very, very interesting. And the first one is that it's free of physical limitation of experiments. It's free from simplification in analytical and empirical models. But what's very important is that it will provide you information where measurements are simply impossible to do. Either if you think of microchannels or microelectromechanical devices that are microns wide, you can't go and make measurements. Or if you're talking about doing measurements in the space shuttle when it re-enters, you want to make measurements to get temperatures, you just can't do it. And also, it provides information everywhere. So if you solve for the velocity and the pressure, you have it everywhere in your computational domain, not just at certain points. And what made the CFD so popular was the fact that two things were occurring at the same time. This is a slide that dates back to 1975 by Dean Chapman from NASA, who collected the information about computers, and the scales here are logarithmic, and basically the computers were getting faster and faster, while the cost of doing experiments of designing these are the various airplanes that were built by various plane manufacturers, going from the DC-3 to the Boeing 737, the B-1, and the space shuttle. These are log scales, so you're talking about here for the space shuttle something like about 10, not quite 10 years of 10 years of wind tunnel time, not 10 years of development, 10 years of wind tunnel time. and the costs here are in the thousands of dollars of 1975. Dean Chapman was so excited at the time that he said CFD was spelling the end of wind tunnels. They'd be used to store computer listings, but it didn't occur. So this is my brief background material about what CFD is and what we do. The question of accuracy has been plaguing serious computational scientists for a long time. It doesn't seem to bother the software vendors so much. One of them even told me once, he says, I've never had a customer complain about accuracy. However, Dimitri Mavrikis, who is Mr. CFD, did a set of calculations that were published about 15 months ago, where he did a nice grid refinement study with up to 72 million grid points with 5 degrees of freedom per point. So we're talking about over 350 million unknowns. So it's a big problem. And it looked like DRAG was doing what it's supposed to. Calculations were improving. But then somebody supplied him with a slightly different mesh, approximately the same size, 72 million grid points, 65 million grid points. The DRAG went from 0.028 down to 0.025. And aerodynamicists use what they call drag counts. It's 1/10,000th of a unit. And they need drag to be accurate to 2 counts. That's 2 units in the last decimal digit. But here's a shift of 30 counts. So mesh resolution seems to be something very important. And the issues of accuracy, reliability, and uncertainty are creeping up again. And this question is how to get there and how to make sure that we are there. How do you get accuracy and how do you make accuracy? If you're thinking about doing optimization at some point, if your state that you get from CFD is erroneous, you're going to get designs that, if you're lucky, you get incompatible gradients and you optimize it and it stops. If you're unlucky, it'll go through and you get a suboptimal design or something that doesn't work. So it comes back to the issues of modeling and simulation. And over here is the laboratory where you run a physical experiment, a wind tunnel, and you make some observations with a hot wire or LDV, laser Doppler velocimetry or whatnot, and you have error measurements. On this side is the computer. So you go from the physics to the mathematical model, which entails that once you feed the mathematical model to the computer, there are some modeling errors. You feed this to your favorite numerical methods. In my case, it's the finite element method. You end up with some predictions that are suffering from numerical errors and so suffering from modeling errors. So when you do the comparisons, how do you tell what is what? If it's numerical errors, there are things you can do. If it's modeling errors, it's a little bit more challenging and exciting. So what I'll discuss is, this is an important issue. A second issue is this one here. If I show you this and I tell you that these symbols are laboratory experiment, and the straight line and the curved lines are two mathematical models predicting the behavior of the system, which of the two models looks the best to you? The curved one. Well, when you go in the lab, you get uncertainties. And if your uncertainty bars behave in this fashion, then the two models are indistinguishable. There's no reason to prefer one to the other. There's no absolute reason to do so. So there are two issues. One is this, the uncertainties on the experiments, and this has been a long tradition in the experimental world of assessing uncertainties in the measurements. The question that comes to us is, how do you put uncertainty bars on CFD predictions? This is another issue. If your plane flies at 300 knots, plus or minus 4%, what's the effect on fuel consumption? What's the uncertainty on fuel consumption? It's very important if you want to get to some place not to run out of fuel. So a few words about the numerical methods. I don't want to go into too much of the details. I'll preach by showing you some examples, but it's the finite element method. It's going from PDEs to AX equals B. And we do this with standard techniques. Newton's method for the nonlinearities, and we do things right, and we know that things behave. The accuracy behaves in certain ways and certain manners, which means that if it's O of H, it means if I decrease my grid size by 2, the error goes down by 2. If it's H square, I divide H by 2, the error goes down by 4. I bring in something that's called adaptive grids, and that's a very sexy, very popular thing to do. But what it boils down to is going from AX equals B to accurate AX equals B. Going from having a pretty picture to having something that's quantitative data about your partial differential equations. There are things in there that have big names here, but basically you need something to estimate the error to find out where things are accurate enough and where things are not. You need some ways of figuring out if you need smaller elements or bigger elements, how to size them. You need something to generate the grid, and you need to sense what's in the solution. Just to show you a few things. This is basically, this is not, the important point of this one is if you look, thinking about pressure, and you assume that there's some exact pressure to the solution, the exact solution that you don't know. Well, the error is the difference between the gradient of the exact pressure minus the gradient of your numerical prediction. And you can compute its norm in this fashion. The problem is you don't have this exact solution. If you had it, you wouldn't be doing the calculation in the first place. So you replace it by something that I call grad PZZ. It's somebody who came up with a way of coming in approximation to this. And the way it works is you basically have your gradients here that looks like this smooth quantity, and this would be your numerical gradients, and the jump, the discontinuities, and you kind of reconstruct an approximation of this thing by least squares. It's just what's important to know is that you have a sensor for accuracy, and the way it works is this is an axisymmetric problem. So it's think of it as this portion here being a pipe, and water is flowing out of the pipe under pressure, and it impinges on the wall, and it's all done underwater. So you have a jet that hits the wall and then curves upwards. So you've done your calculation on this grid. And you get your errors, you tag the elements for it that needs to be refined, you have the error tags here. If you look here, these two elements were tagged, and then you do the little dance, the little calculation, and you find out that you get fine elements. So you can do this repeatedly, starting from something very coarse, and you get to be something that looks like this, up to almost to here. And this would be the last grid, and you can almost read the solution here. There's a shear layer, and you can sense that the edge of the flow along the vertical wall is around here. The question is how do we know if we are there? Have we done enough of these things for our purpose or not? And that's another issue: is how much work do you have to expend so that the calculation makes sense? And the calculation is useful. And the speaker will talk after me, will tell you that there are many times it's just impossible to do this. Here's an example, just to drive the point home. This is an experiment. It's flow in a sudden expansion in a pipe. So you have a pipe that's 10 centimeters in diameter that is connected to a pipe that's 30 centimeters in diameter. And there's a vortex ring. There's a ring of vortex that generates recirculation. They measured the length here. It's seven diameters plus or minus half a diameter. And all these guys have done predictions with the same model, same turbulence models, same code, different meshes, and different slightly tweaking the code. The only exception is Jelinka here, who was a student of mine and works with Jean-Francois now, and did the adaptive grids. But you see the discrepancies. This is frightening, if you think of it. So this brings us to an issue that's been I've stumbled into a little bit by accident. It's verification and validation. And I want to provide some definitions for this. Because in an English thesaurus, verification and validation are synonymous. It means the same thing. But we're going to use this in a technical context. We're doing engineering, we're doing computations, and in CFD, the words will have acquired have acquired an accepted technical meaning. The same words can have different technical meanings in different contexts. For example, if you talk about a model, it could be a pretty girl or a pretty guy on a displaying nice clothing for the year. To medical researcher, a model is a rat for studying illness. To an architect, a model is a small scale version. To us, a model means something else. It's a mathematical model. In the mechanical and aerospace engineering community, verification has the meaning of this. The process of verification is trying to answer this equation. Are we solving the equation right? And validation is, are we solving the right equations for this problem? And as we'll see in the next slide, these two things are very, very different. In fact, it's a bit unfortunate that verification, the two words came out. There should have been three, although we'll see in a few moments. Verification is what I call a mathematical activity. It's numerical analysis. And it's answering the question, again, let's put it in a different way. Are we doing good numerical analysis for the differential equations at hand? Are we doing a good job? Are we doing what we're supposed to do? And it's things like, is the computer program that I've developed second order accurate the way it's supposed to? This, I open this handbook and it says if I use this finite element method, or if I use this finite difference scheme, as I decrease the mesh size by a factor of 2, the error is going to go down by a factor of 4. So have I done a good implementation? So you're talking about verifying the code, making sure the code works according to specs. Then the tougher issue is if it's second order accurate and according to specs and it follows specs, am I using the code properly on the problem I'm interested in for a simulation? This would be a practical problem. I'm talking about doing a calculation for getting information for a design and to size a part, something like that. It's called simulation verification. And this is where I said it should have been more than two words, because validation is something different. There are two steps in the verification. One is verifying the tool, and the second is verifying if you're using the tool, if the tool is delivering everything you need when you're using it. Validation, on the other hand, is physics, it's science, it's engineering. It has nothing to do with numerical analysis. The question is, are we doing good engineering modeling for the problem at hand? Are we doing what we're supposed to on the science part? And what you need to do this is to compare to measurements. But if you want to compare to measurements, you need two things. You need measurements that are very accurate, very complete, very exhaustive. And so far, I haven't seen one experiment that does that. Most of the experiments that are available in the literature have been done for other purposes, like computing mass transfer or figuring out the evaporation rates. You have wonderful data, but you don't have all the details to make sure that your computational model and the model in the lab are exactly the same thing. So first you need very good data. And then you need very good predictions, which means you need a tool that's been verified and a simulation that's been verified. If you don't have this, then you're cranking beautiful color pictures and you don't know what you're comparing to. And I'll show you an example where agreement is perfect until you try to do better and you find out that it gets worse. So verification is, are we solving the equations right? And proceeds in two steps. Code verification is done with what I'll discuss in a few minutes by the method of manufactured solutions. It's a way of getting true errors and to do a verifying study. It's a benchmark, foolproof. Simulation verification relies on the estimators, the way I showed you a little bit earlier. And I repeat myself here, just for completeness. So, Polya once said, was a computer scientist, once said, only a fool starts at the beginning, the wise starts at the end. So the method of manufactured solution is one way to verify a code. And basically what you do is start from the end. You pick your continuum solution, you pick a solution, whatever you like. You put it in the partial differential equations, you determine what the source term has to be to make sure that it balances out. Because if you pick something at random, you stick it in the differential equations, it's not going to be zero. So this guy picks up the slack. You implement in your solver, We perform grid refinement studies, and you can check for its code accuracy and reliability. So here's an example. I'll pick a solution ahead of time. I said U of T x is x plus a sine x plus ct. So it's an unsteady, looks like an unsteady problem in one dimension. And I'll apply it to one simple partial differential equation. It's called Berger's equation. It's a model of the Navier-Stokes equations in 1D, if you want. It's nonlinear because of this term here. So if you stick u into this equation and by putting everything on the left-hand side, it's not going to be equal to zero. It's going to define your source term that I call q1, which is what's left when you substitute u into L, the operator of the differential equation. It's your out-of-balance term. If you do this, you find out that this guy looks as this side, this latitude. This looks like this. And then the solution a plus sine x plus ct is then a solution of this modified equation. You do this, and this is a natural to many people. I did this unknowingly, naturally in the early 80s, only to discover that later on that Patrick Roach had put a name onto it, and the name stuck, and he started doing it at the same time I did, but he was clever. He ran a little bit faster to the home base. If you notice, we haven't specified what the domain is. It could be either 0, 1, or 10 minus 100. Boundary conditions, we haven't talked about. We derive them from the manufactured solution. And because you derive them from the manufactured solution, you can check all kinds of combinations of boundary conditions easily. Here's a second example. I pick the same solution. I modify my differential equations to add this nasty guy here. I get a source term that looks like, now it will be computed like this. It's different, but it's the same solution. So I have this solution, a plus sine x plus ct, is a solution of two partial differential equations that are different, with two different source terms. So you can use the solution to verify, to do the code verification on several different codes. It could be a Navier-Stokes code. It could be a groundwater flow code. It could be whatever you have under your hand. And how do you do this? How do you do the verification? It's very simple, very, very simple. Your error is defined as your finite element prediction minus your exact solution. Because you have a manufactured solution, you have this guy. So you know what this is. And if the scheme is pth order accurate, and I'll say here an example with first order and second order, if you start with an H1 is equal to as a mesh size of H, you get and assume that you start with the same error. You just do calculations by dividing H by 2 and then H by 2 again and by 2 again, for instance. It doesn't have to be by 2, but it's convenient. Then if you do a calculation to find out that if the scheme is first order, then the error goes down by a factor of 2 at each time. If the scheme is second order accurate, it goes down by a factor of 4 at each time. So you just need to monitor this, and voila. What people say about this is that it's terrific, but it's so incredibly sensitive that people get frustrated because it finds the tiniest thing that will prevent this behavior from occurring. It's so sensitive that I've come to think of it, when it's well done, it has a theorem-like flavor. If you have it, you don't have a theorem, but if you're close to having a theorem, prove that your code is correct for this. Here's an example for a boundary layer over a flat plate. That would be stick a flat plate in a turbulent flow, and the flow slows down because of the turbulence and the viscous forces, and you pick a solution that looks like this. We manufactured this to test, verify up to 7 turbulence models. Here's the grid that we've obtained after 5 cycles of refinement. There's 250,000 grid points. And here are, on this plot here, I have 3 pairs of curves, one for the pressure, one for the velocity, and one for the turbulence viscosity, which is a part of our model. And we see that the curves come in pair. One is the true error, and the other one is the estimator that I use to control my mesh size. So you can see that it goes down at a given rate, and the two curves kind of tend to go together, so it builds up confidence in the tools that we have. Now let's move on to verification and validation of simulations, because these usually get done almost at the same time. Here's some examples that I like. It's the same code that's been used to do the two. It's the code that I developed at Ecole Polytechnique. This is a pipe expansion, so it's the same I was telling you about earlier, 10 centimeter duct that expands into a 30 centimeter diameter duct. Two numerical discretization, two finite element schemes, and this is the experimental measurements for the recirculation length of the vortex. So we see that not only do the prediction converge to a common value, so we say the solution is verified, but we can say it's validated in the sense that it converges to what it's supposed to from the physical point of view. It matches the physics. So the fact that these curves are horizontal and together tells us that we're doing good numerics, and the fact that these two curves lie almost on top of the measurement point tells us that we're doing reasonable physics. I took the same code and put it in a 30-degree diffuser, so I do the nice thing of putting something to reduce the friction loss, the losses. I have five numerical schemes here with adaptive grids. This is the recirculation. So we see here that some start with no separation, some start with separation, and my student was so excited. He started with this grid, got this one, and then got this result. Says, I'm right on the experiment. And I said, why don't you let the program run some more grids? And suddenly things started to go down, and he ran all of these, and they all kept the same thing. Five finite element schemes that are different lead roughly to the same prediction here, 3.5 instead of 4. So they all lead to the same wrong answer. So we know that the numerics is good because we have this behavior. So the solution is verified in the sense that we have a very good approximation of the exact solution to the flow equations, but it's not validated in the sense that it doesn't match the real world. We don't do good engineering modeling. Here's another example that's even worse. It's the impinging jet I showed you earlier. This is a plot of the turbulence kinetic energy at the radius r of d of 0.5, which is about here. It's along z, so it's along this line here. These are the measurements. These are the predictions on the grids. And as you see, the solid line is this one. The solutions are verified. They get to lie on top of each other. But we're a factor of 10 off in intensity of turbulence. But things can get even nastier than that. If you have that, then you know that something's wrong, and you have the results tell you something. This is a flow in what is called a manifold. It's a turnaround duct. It's a annulus that turns around itself. It's the manifold of one of the manifolds of the space shuttle. And we did a turbulent flow, and we did the turbulent flow in this with meshes generated adaptively starting from 700 grid points to nearly 100,000 grid points. And this basically tells us this is the plot of the velocity along this boundary here. And when it goes below zero, it tells us that there's separation. So if you use grids that are like here at 14,000 or even 30,000 grid points, which are relatively fine, there's no separation yet. And separation is something very bad from a design point of view. It's only when you get to the finer grids that you find out that you have separation. And that's because one element of the boundary conditions, which depends, the nonlinear boundary condition that depends on the solution itself, starts completely off and takes a lot of grid points to converge. You have to be patient. This one is a big image to load. This is another experiment I showed you. You saw the vortex shedding, the nice picture on the lower right-hand side. This is a steady-state version of it. And we did grids up to 8 grids with 500,000 grid points in 2 dimensions. It's crazy, but it's near dementia, I'd say. You have to be demented to do things like this. But if you look at the zoom, you can almost read the solution in the way the grid is designed. What's important to look at is if you're looking at skin friction, you want to figure out how much friction is on the plate to figure out, because friction is what generates, tells you how much friction you have, will tell you how big your engine has to be the slide at that speed. Well, you find out if you look here that it takes a while to settle down. Lift and drag coefficients, you find out, for instance, here, this would be the drag coefficient, or the drag coefficient. You have some oscillations in it. And these oscillations are not very good if you're trying to do optimization. You may end up with a false minima. If you look at the detail, you find out that skin friction is real difficult to get accurately. However, if you look at this is unfortunate that it's cut this part because it's the best part. We compare here the velocity at one diameter downstream, so it's a velocity on the vertical axis at one diameter. So we go through the data reasonably well. And this is the transverse velocity component, so it depends who looks at these results. When I looked at them, I said, this is not very good. But when Robert Martinuzzi looked at it, he said, it's not bad for the crudeness of your turbulence model.
What about Reynolds number?
Depending on the problem, between 0 and 10 million. Here it's about 22,000. So just to summarize, what we've done so far before we move on to another issue is code verification. It basically tells you that your code and its use are reliable. If you do this properly, you get a stamp of approval. You can stamp your code as saying it does what it's supposed to do. Simulation verification, it's solution accuracy that's estimated. It says, I did this calculation and I believe the results are accurate to so much. I'm not giving you the details of it, it's in the books, it's not very complicated. Simulation validations, it tells you that the model is accurate and reliable for this class of flows. Not all flows. If you think of the two examples I showed you with the pipe and the diffuser, it's the same turbulence model, same code, two different configurations. One is good, one is bad. What's really difficult is to have very accurate, exhaustive data to ensure that the simulation and the experiments are of the same problem. What usually happens in these problems is that you have to guess some of the boundary conditions for some of the variables. And as soon as you start guessing, then your guess is as good as mine. And the results can be quite different. So this brings me to the sensitivity and uncertainty analysis part. It's probably the most abstract part of the talk. The simplest way I found to describe what a sensitivity is if you think about heat conduction in one dimension across a wall. So you have here, I don't know, a material that would be copper, and this would be a very good insulator, say some bakelite or some wood. And you impose a boundary condition, you impose a temperature T1 and T2 at the two extremities, and the materials interface is located at X of I. When you look into a book, a heat conduction book, you'll find out that you tend to think of temperature as temperature is a function of X. In fact, the temperature depends on X, it's the range of its application, but also depends on the parameters, T1 and T2, the temperatures and the boundary conditions. Kappa 1 and kappa 2, the conductivities, and xi, the interface, and x2, the right-hand extremity. If you change these dimensions, the problem changes, and so the solution does. So a sensitivity with respect to a parameter A is simply the partial derivative of the temperature with respect to this parameter, which would be in this set here. And what this tells you is how the system reacts to first order. This is the first component in a Taylor series expansion of temperature in terms of A. So if you apply a unit perturbation to parameter A, you change A by one unit, then dTdA tells you how much the system is going to respond to first order accuracy in the sense of a Taylor series. So it gives you a lot of insight as to what goes on, because it gives you trends as to what your parameters are going to do, the effect they're going to have on your system. And you can do all sorts of interesting things with it. When you compute the gradient of a cost function, you've applied the chain rule. So you have the Jacobian, and you get du, d alpha, and Jacobian with respect to the pressure, dp, d alpha. These would be the sensitivities of velocity and pressure. So if you can compute these animals, you can do optimization. Not a whole lot of people do it that way, because there are more efficient ways of doing it with adjoint methods. But what's interesting with sensitivities is that you can do what I call the fast evaluation of nearby solutions via Taylor series. If you have your solution at an angle of attack for an airfoil at alpha zero, and you're interested in figuring out what goes on at alpha zero plus the delta alpha, if you can compute the first sensitivity or the first and second sensitivity with respect to alpha, you can use the Taylor series expansion. To compute this, see the pressure coefficient here with the pressure, you need to solve Navier-Stokes equations. When you need to compute these guys, you solve a linear system, so they're cheap. So it'll give you trends, and it's applicable to just about everything in the flow. Not only that, but if you have this information, it's exactly what you need to do first or second order statistics for cascading uncertainty in the input through the CFD program to get uncertainty estimates on your outputs. And I'll show you some examples in a few minutes. How do you get, there are many ways, how do you get the sensitivities, how do you compute these sensitivities? There are many ways. You can do finite difference of solutions, you can differentiate the system of equation. I prefer to take the PDEs and differentiate them. For instance, you take the continuity equation, conservation of mass, you differentiate with respect to A and assume that you can smooth enough that you can switch the derivatives with respect to space and parameter, and you end up with a continuity equation for your sensitivities. You do the same thing for the momentum equation, and because you have these products here, you end up with a bunch of terms here. They kind of expand. So there are lots of terms that appear. It's exactly identical to the Newtonization, and you get one system of partial differential equations per parameter. So they're linear, so they're really cheap to solve. If you do second order sensitivities, you have to be a little bit patient and determined in computing the first and second derivatives. If you take the momentum equation, the sensitivity with respect to parameter A for the momentum equation, differentiate with B, you get the equations for sensitivity with respect to AB, second order. We've done it. The nice thing is that you need to do it only once, and you code it up, and that's done forever. Here's an example of application. It's an airfoil in laminar flow at a Reynolds number of 2,000. We have an angle of 3 degrees, angle of attack. So if you look here, you see the wake here. It's slightly going up. It's because the flow is at 3 degrees with respect to the horizontal. 3 degrees plus or minus 1% of 3 degrees, and u infinity is 1 plus or minus 1%. So you go back. And we go back and we apply the second order statistics, and you end up with a prediction of the wake that's taken at 5% of a chord downstream. So this is just downstream of the airfoil. So you have two boundary layers that merge. So you have high speed flow here towards the top and high speed flow towards the bottom. And the wake has slowed down the flow to about nearly zero because it's right close to the trailing edge. So the dashed line is my nominal prediction for 3 degrees angle of attack and one. And these are my uncertainty bars if I assume that I have 1% accuracy on the angle of attack and 1% accuracy on the velocity. It gives me some intervals in which to place my predictions, the uncertainty intervals. You can do this for the block I showed you earlier. It's turbulent flow. It's a lot more complicated, but it's the same rigmarole. And here is I have here the symbols. The symbols are the measurements for the streamwise velocity at x equals 1, and I have two curves. The solid curve is the nominal prediction, and I have the predictions for the uncertainty. So I've forgotten what the uncertainty is on U0, but you get the uncertainty interval plotted here, U plus or minus delta U, it's uncertainty. And you see that in some places, the uncertainty explained the discrepancy between the prediction and the measurements, and some other parts it doesn't explain it away. So even if you account for uncertainty, you cannot always say that you have validated calculations, but not you have verified calculations, but not validated with the experiments. This is another example for the Reynolds stress, the turbulent stresses that are induced in the flow. Which brings me to towards the end of my presentation. We're going to just show you to loop to loop, started with design, we're going to end with design. We start with a profile that looks like this. We represent it with nerves, which are non-uniform rational B-splines. It's just a fancy name for an interpolation function to represent the geometry with just a few points, control points. And the arrows means that our degrees of freedom are either the x-coordinate or the vertical motion of the point. If you move this point, if you change the geometry of the airfoil. So we have 12 control points. So we end up with, because if some control points are fixed and some others are constrained, we end up with 10 degrees of freedom. So I solve my Navier-Stokes equations plus sensitivities for 10 geometrical parameters. Then I do my 10-dimensional gradient-based optimization to find the next one. And I do this a few times. And I'll do this to maximize the ratio of lift to drag. So for this airfoil, initial drag coefficient is 0.1234. This is just the way it came out. Lift is 0.019, and the cost function, the lift to drag ratio, is 0.1541. So these colorful pictures are the sensitivities with respect to the location of the control point number 5, which is here, or the y location of control point number 8. On the bottom is a different approach. It's much more difficult to understand. But what's important is that wherever it goes red means that things will increase, and whenever it goes to blue, it means things will decrease. So increasing the parameter here, because it goes to red from the leading edge, increasing this parameter will increase the velocity. It amounts to moving the lower portion of the airfoil up. If you move the underside of the airfoil up, there's more room for the air to flow. So the flow will be at higher speed because you've just made more room. And here we'd be moving the airfoil position up, so you'd be slowing down the fluid. So we've done this and let the thrust region algorithm iterate for 7 design iterations. And we find out that our drag has gone down slightly. Our lift has gone up tremendously, and the cost function has gone, the lift to drag ratio has been maximized. And the airfoil, initial airfoil, is the dotted one, and the final design is this bulbous thing, which is characteristics of low Reynolds number in compressible flows. Now, the interesting part about uncertainty analysis is that you can, as I showed you earlier, is you can transpose this to design. And you can compute uncertainties with respect to the discretization errors, the stopping criteria of your optimizer. If you have a slack, the criterion is not very demanding, then you don't know exactly where is your optimum. The uncertainty of the inflow on the Reynolds number and the angle of attack, and the geometrical uncertainty, the coordinates of the control point. If you can do this, and you can come up with these. Yeah, this is the total uncertainty. Yellow is the cost function, orange is drag, orange is lift, and blue is drag. So if you have a numerical uncertainty contribution, the optimization contribution, the flow uncertainty contribution, and geometrical uncertainty contribution. So this allows you to rank the order of your parameters and say, if I want a better design, I need to get a better flow. I need to reduce my uncertainty on the flow, on the upstream flow. And if I can decrease this to much lower level, then I'll know that I'll be able to work on a geometry. If I start working on a geometry, it's not going to change anything. This brings me to my conclusions. CFT can be very powerful if you use it properly. It's not a black box by a long shot, and Jean-François will show you that some of those. There's much research left to do. Verification is a way of ensuring that your code is accurate, and if you get accurate, and assessing the accuracy quantitatively for the code in the simulation. Validation is issues with reliability and realism with a mathematical model, and it's not as trivial as one might think. Sensitivity equation method, as or sensitivities in general, are very useful because of the insight they provide, the uncertainty bands of the flow response, and also the ranking of the importance of the parameters that you can get with it. And I've shown you a successful application to airfoil design. Then again, if that's it, my calculation was done properly. So there's much left to discover and do, and so for some of us, jet security is not so bad. And before I leave you, I want to say this is what Hamming, who was a giant in computing, said: the purpose of computing is insight, not numbers. And some wisecrack said in 1980, 7 years later, that the purpose of computing is not yet insight. And I'd like to leave you on this on the following note: that if you have some big computations to do, get yourself one of these. Thank you very much.